Islam is in the news all the time because of violent takeover of large sections of Iraq and portions of Syria. There's Muslim violence in Nigeria, Kenya, Pakistan, not to mention Afghanistan. It never stops. There are reports of beheadings, even of children. I personally have seen video showing the heads of Syrian soldiers on pikes placed every few feet by a gate out in a public place. Barbarism is on the march in our modern world, and it all seems to center around Islam. Robert Spencer joins us to discuss this. He heads jihadwatch.org and is the author of many books on Islam, including his newest, Arab Winter. Robert, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks. Always happy to be here.
Sure. Okay, first of all, explain to us what ISIS is, or sometimes it's called ISIL, and lately they're just calling it IS.
Well, the confusion comes from the Arabic word Shams, which is essentially Syria and Lebanon, or the Levant. And there's no good translation for that, so people have called it the Islamic State of Syria and of Iraq and the Levant, or alternately the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, hence ISIS or ISIL. Meanwhile, the Islamic State itself has said, we are not either one anymore, we are just the Islamic State. Full stop. And so that's people have been calling it IS or the Islamic State. The Islamic State considers itself to be the new caliphate. The caliph, historically in Sunni Islam, was the successor of Muhammad as the political, military, and spiritual leader of all the Muslims worldwide. And accordingly, someone of tremendous authority, the only person in Sunni Islamic law authorized to wage offensive jihad as opposed to defensive jihad. And the difference being that the offensive jihad does not need to be justified by any grievance or any action on the part of non-Muslims, whereas it might seem hard to believe for people, but all the jihads we have seen in the world over the last few years, including the 9/11 jihad attacks, were cast as defensive. That's why when Osama bin Laden justified 9/11, he did so by listing this long list of grievances. He had to, because otherwise this jihad would have been unlawful under Islamic law. Now, that is no longer necessary as far as people in the Islamic State are concerned. They have not only the right, but the responsibility under Islamic law to strike regularly at non-Muslim states and to try to conquer and Islamize them. So that means that the declaration of the caliphate by the Islamic State means we ain't seen nothing yet. That as hard as it may seem to believe, the jihad activity in the United States is going to get much more frequent, much more violent in the coming years, unless the Islamic State is stopped.
Wow. All right. First of all, what was that word that you said in Arabic that has different different meanings? Can you break that word down and spell it at least phonetically?
I'm sorry, Jerry. I don't know which word you're referring to.
Oh, it was at the very beginning. The where it could be Syria or Levant.
Oh, Shams. S-H-A-M-S.
S-H-A-M-S. And that appears where in that conflagration or in that...
The name of the group in Arabic is the Islamic State of Iraq and Ash-Shams.
Ah.
The Levant or Syria and Lebanon, yeah. Et cetera.
Levant is what we could call the Holy Land, right?
The Holy Land as well. Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, essentially those. I guess Jordan possibly as well. It's certainly the Islamic State has designs on all those areas and includes them in its preliminary maps of its aspirations.
Okay, the caliphate. Explain that, and did I understand you to say, or perhaps it was implied, that the caliphate and the concept of the caliphate only exists within the Sunni tradition. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
it's not a Shiite thing at all.
All right, so just to put this in perspective, that roughly of the 100% of Muslims, 85% or so would be Sunnis, and 15% would be Shiites. I suppose there's some small percentages of some other small splinter groups or whatever, but they're so marginal. So the Shiites, the ones from Iran, they're not even expecting a caliphate any day.
No, they have a different view. I mean, of course, at the beginning of the Sunni-Shiite split was over this, that there were the Muslims after Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, died suddenly. They all thought that there should be a caliph, a successor, But the Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, was centered around Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali ibn Abi Talib, and they believed that Ali was the rightful successor of Muhammad, or the rightful caliph, because he was a member of Muhammad's household. Muhammad didn't have any sons, and so Ali, as his son-in-law, was sort of the closest thing. Now, as far as that went, though, he was not chosen. He was passed over several times until finally he became the fourth caliph and was murdered a few years later, as three of the four early caliphs were. And after that, there were several attempts by his son to gain the caliphate, until finally he was killed in a battle with the Sunnis in the year 680. And that was the end of, that was the formal split between the Sunnis and the Shiites. And after that, the Shiites have, they established what is known as the Imamate. In the Sunni Muslim tradition, you have the Imam is sort of like your local pastor, the head of the local house of worship. But in Shiite Islam, the Imam is the leader of the Muslims, the successor of Muhammad, the caliph in effect, but it's a different idea of the caliphate. He has to be a relative, he has to be a member of Muhammad's household, that is, and it's a hereditary thing, and he has something of Muhammad's prophetic spirit within him. So it's a more exalted idea than in the Sunni tradition, which is just the an ordinary human leader without any kind of prophetic charism, or at least supposed prophetic charism.
All right, now going back to the caliphate, it's my understanding that after World War I, which started literally 100 years ago from the very month of this recording, August 2014, after that, didn't the caliph basically get deposed and didn't exist for a while? And now you're saying that ISIS or ISIL or IS is now claiming they're reestablishing the caliph. Would that make al-Baghdadi the caliph, effectively?
Yes. Yes, that's what they're calling him, the Caliph Ibrahim. And they're saying that he is indeed the new caliph after it has been abolished in 1924. The Ottoman Empire was the last caliphate, and the Sultan was the guardian of the caliphate. But the Ottoman Empire fell after World War I, and the secular Turkish government abolished the caliphate in 1924. Now, it's not very well known, but the primary fundamental aspiration of Islamic Jihad groups around the world, like Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab and all the others, Boko Haram, has been to restore the caliphate. They consider that to be a terrible wound to the Muslim community worldwide, because they believe that Muslims are divided in these phony nation states, and that Muslims do not rightly owe allegiance to any nation state, but only to the caliphate. But of course, there has been no caliphate now for 90 years. And the aspiration of the Muslims, of the Muslim jihad groups, has been to restore the caliphate. But the Islamic State has been more successful in establishing a claim to do so, at least so far. The Al-Qaeda group in Afghanistan actually proclaimed Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, as the caliph in 1996. But that claim was never accepted by any significant group outside Afghanistan. There was an Algerian jihad group that accepted it a few years after that, but nothing much came of it. This is the first sustained attempt to restore the caliphate. Of course, many Muslims worldwide have rejected it, and it is a might-makes-right proposition, Jerry. Whether the caliphate in the Islamic State is accepted by a large number of Muslims worldwide will be determined by how long it lasts, how much it's able to sustain itself, and so on.
The fellow that you mentioned who was proclaimed to be a caliph, you know, in the 1990s, who lived in Afghanistan, is he alive today? And if not, how did he meet his end?
He appears to be alive today.
Oh, okay.
He's very much in hiding. He's been in hiding for the most part since the U.S. entered Afghanistan. And he seems to be still alive, but he doesn't make appearances very often at all.
All right, we're talking right now with Robert Spencer. He directs jihadwatch.org, which is vital for information on Islam. And let's face it, Islam is always in the news because of all these killings. His latest book is called Arab Winter. You can learn about it and on that website, and terrific book. In fact, my wife was even reading it just the other day, Robert. So part of the reason I think we're losing this thing is because it's so hard to pronounce the names of these people. But this fellow al-Baghdadi, it sounds like this is somebody that we all ought to know about his biography. How old is he? Where is he from? What's his background?
Well, nobody knows a whole lot about him. He seems to have been in U.S. custody a few years back and was released. And he notoriously said when he was released, he said to his captors, "I'll see you guys in New York." And in any case, he it was a member of Al-Qaeda, and then he broke with Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda since the death of Osama bin Laden, apparently over strategy in Iraq. And Zawahiri seemed to want to de-emphasize the jihad operations in Iraq. Al-Baghdadi wanted to re-emphasize them, and so he went his own way. He was able to get a considerable number of Muslims to go with him, and has access to considerable resources. And so he's been able to take advantage of the chaos with the civil war in Syria and the chaos with the weak Shiite regime in Baghdad to take over large swaths of Iraqi and Syrian territory to proclaim his new caliphate there.
Now, they seem to be, that is IS, let's just call them Islamic State, they seem to be more violent than Al-Qaeda even though that seems almost hard to believe.
Well, you know, people have made a whole lot of the split between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, and I don't really think there's much to that. I think it's a distinction without a difference. It's just that the Islamic State is perhaps a little more open and unapologetic about what it does, and brazen about what it does, because it considers itself to have a legitimacy that the others didn't have. As I was explaining before about how all jihad had to be defensive in the absence of the caliph, well, the Islamic State does not consider that there is an absence of a caliph anymore, and so they enforce Islamic law fully and unapologetically, including the beheadings and stonings and so on. But of course, Al-Qaeda believes in all that as well. It's not as if they're really doing anything that Al-Qaeda would reject in principle on Islamic grounds.
Right. Okay, got it. All right, now, how do we, here in America, how do we filter the reports and know what's legitimate and what's not legitimate? I mean, I remember reading about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was an email sent out, kind of an alert, and it was saying that 1,000 Christians have supposedly been beheaded this very morning in Baghdad by ISIS. And I'm thinking, in Baghdad? Wow, if Baghdad fell or portions of Baghdad fell, I think we'd hear about it in the regular news. On the other hand, we are hearing about children being cut in half and other things like that by these monsters. So how do we filter, how do we know what's true and what's not true?
Well, of course, it's very difficult if we're not there. But for all their faults, I still think that it's best to stick with reports that come from the international news services like AP and Reuters and so on.
Yeah.
And obviously, as you noted, the Islamic State is not in Baghdad. So even though they are beheading people, and we know they are, and they are terrorizing Christians, and we know they're doing that as well, they're not doing it in Baghdad. They have essentially cleared out Mosul, which was historically a Christian area of Christians, and have terrorized the Christians there, converted 45 churches into mosques and so on. But in Baghdad, they're not there yet. The Iranians would not let them take Baghdad.
Huh. All right. Well, we know about the journalists being beheaded. Any comments about that, and especially the fact that apparently the one who actually did the cutting of the man's head, cut off James Foley's head, was from Britain. And in fact, they even jokingly, I guess, call him, as he's one of the Beatles, so-called, among some of those ISIS members.
Yeah, as it happens, apparently there is a group of four Muslims from Britain. And so because they are four guys with British accents, and the other foreign fighters there don't have the British accents, they're known as the Beatles. And apparently Beatle John, the leader, beheaded this journalist Foley. It's just kind of a really terrible testimony of how in countries like Britain there is the preaching of jihad and Islamic supremacism in the mosques, and it's not being monitored. It's not even known. And because of the British government's anxiousness to appease its Muslim minority, nothing is being done about it. And meanwhile, Britain has become essentially a new recruiting ground for jihadis, as have other Western governments. There are Muslims from pretty much every Western country in Iraq now fighting for the Islamic State. And it just shows up the cognitive dissonance of the mainstream narrative about Muslims in the West, because we're constantly told that no Muslims in the West, none, zero, zip, have any kind of allegiance to a group like Al-Qaeda or a group like the Islamic State, that they're all moderate and pluralist here, that anybody who believes otherwise is just a vicious Islamophobe, bigoted hate monger, and so on. And so that would make it absolutely inconceivable, were that true, that any Muslim would go from a Western country to fight jihad alongside the Islamic State. And yet we do see that happening. And yet then when we look back at the mosques in the United States and elsewhere, we see that there is absolutely no program, not one, anywhere, to teach young Muslims to avoid the understanding of Islam that is represented by the Islamic State, even though it is ostensibly something that they reject. And so the cognitive dissonance is huge, but nobody seems to mind. Nobody seems to care.
Well, would this fellow, you know, Beetle John, so to speak, would he be, let's say, of Pakistan origin or something like that, or from Morocco, but he happened to be growing up in Britain? Or was he native born? Pardon me?
As far as I know, he's a convert to Islam.
Oh, wow.
A native born Englishman who converted to Islam, of which, of course, there are many, and we have seen quite a few of them engaged in jihad activity, as well as in Britain with the violent Sharia patrols there, where there were Muslims, including a notorious red-haired convert, who were putting up signs saying this is a Sharia area, Islamic law is enforced in this area, and then terrorizing and menacing people who were holding alcohol, or people who, women who were not dressed according to Islamic norms, or couples, et cetera. And so this is something that, here again, points up this abject failure of British authorities to deal with this problem adequately. They're just in total denial about what's being taught among Muslims in Britain, and now they're reaping the consequences.
Yeah, we're being told over and over and over, Islam is a religion of peace. And it's like, wow, that's interesting. Where is that the case?
Yes, exactly. It's constantly an attempt to get us to reject the evidence of our senses and the evidence of the daily headlines in favor of comforting abstractions that actually are shown to be true nowhere in the world today.
Huh. Okay, explain to us about Muslim views of eschatology. Does that play a role here? There's a famous American general who said that we have to understand this kind of, this is understandable in terms of apocalyptic thinking, end of times thinking on the part of some of these Muslim leaders, perhaps al-Baghdadi amongst them. Can you explain about eschatology and Islam?
At a time of great persecution of the Muslims, according to Islamic tradition, the Mahdi, or savior figure, is going to arise and return to the earth along with Jesus. Jesus not being, of course, Jesus of Christianity, but Jesus, the Muslim prophet, who is an enemy, essentially, of Christianity. And together, the Mahdi and Jesus will wage war. The Islamic hadith, the traditions say that Jesus will come back and break the cross, kill the pigs, and abolish the jizya. Those are three separate and important motions. He will break the cross because in the Islamic understanding, Jesus did not die on the cross, and it's a great insult to him as a Muslim prophet to claim that he did die on the cross and that Allah essentially allowed him to be defeated. And so he will break the cross, that is, destroy Orthodox Christianity. He will kill the pigs, that is the symbol of the Christians' refusal to obey the dietary laws that are set down for Muslims, and will abolish the jizya being the tax that is mandated for the subjugated Christians to pay under Islamic law. But when the Mahdi and Jesus return, then they will abolish the jizya because it will no longer be allowed for the Christians to live subservient to the Muslims in an Islamic state. Rather, the Christians will have to submit. They will have, convert or die. And so the savior figure will essentially conquer and Islamize the world at that point in conjunction with Jesus. And so the problem here is that this is going to happen when the Muslims are persecuted, according to these traditions, like they never have been before. And so it's possible that, and some people have speculated this, that the caliph al-Baghdadi is thinking he can bring on the coming of the Mahdi and the consummation of all things by triggering a persecution of the Muslims that is virulent enough to bring about this end time scenario. And how can he trigger that persecution? Well, by essentially going to war against everyone, as even is prophesied in the book of Genesis, you recall, Jerry, with Ishmael, his being a wild ass of a man, and his being against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And then with the whole world against them and provoking a world war, then this would supposedly bring about the coming of the Mahdi.
Wow. So in other words, they're, in a sense, trying to exacerbate world conditions so that their savior will come.
Yes, absolutely.
Sort of like trying to speed up the process of the return of, well, I don't want to say the return of Christ. But, I mean, that's what Christians are waiting for, of course.
Yes.
All right.
The end times.
Yeah.
And the problem is that there is, that is in Islamic tradition, Jerry, in several places. That there are statements that strongly suggest that the Muslims can bring about the end times by their own actions. And this is very dangerous because it's connected to murder. It's connected to killing. For example, there is a statement of Muhammad that is in the Hadith that says the end times will not come until Muslims kill Jews. And the Jews hide behind trees, and the trees call out, "Oh, Muslim, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him." Now, note that he said, according to this tradition, the end times will not come until Muslims kill Jews and the Jews hide behind trees and so on. And so if you're reading that as a believing Muslim and you think that Muhammad really said that, then the conclusion is clear that you can bring about this. You can bring about this glorious the end time scenario by killing Jews.
Wow. Okay, in case you just joined us, we're talking with Robert Spencer, author of Arab Winter and other books on Islam. He's the director of jihadwatch.org. This is Jerry Newcomb, and I'm on Vocal Point. And Robert, as we continue this discussion on Islam and this threat, it's my understanding that there's a statement from the Quran along the lines of, oh, if you kill one person, it's as if you kill many persons. And some have said that in a sense is like the statement from the Old Testament, thou shalt do no murder, from the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, you're talking about chapter 5, verse 32 of the Quran, which says that if anyone, it's actually a warning to the children of Israel. It's not a general command. And that's important to keep in mind, because actually this is a statement that's taken from the Talmud and is placed in the Quran from there. And it says that that Allah gave a warning to the children of Israel that to kill one innocent person was like killing the whole world. And to save one innocent person was like saving the whole world. Now, this is the favorite Quran verse of Barack Obama and George W. Bush. It's the only one they've ever quoted, and many other Western authorities. And they think that it means that Muslims are forbidden to kill and should be compassionate and merciful and so on. What they don't do is go actually open the Quran and read the passage in context. It is actually yet another harangue against the Jews, who are the villains of the Quran again and again, and of Islamic tradition. And it shows that the idea here is that the Jews have transgressed against Allah's command by killing people other than those who they were supposed to be killing. And then the passage goes on to say that the penalty for those who wage war against Allah and his messenger, which is here again the children of Israel, is to be killed or crucified or the hand and the foot amputated on either side, that is the left hand and the right foot or the right hand and the left foot, and exile from the land. And so it's hardly a message of mercy and compassion. It is actually saying, we told you not to kill innocent people. You did kill innocent people. You went to war against Allah and his messenger, and therefore you should be killed or crucified or your hand and foot amputated. And that is really what the passage means. But taken in isolation, that one verse, chapter 5, verse 32, does appear to say that if you kill one innocent person, it's like killing the whole world. This is, however, not ever understood in isolation by Islamic jihadis. They read the whole Quran, and so they read on, and they see that the penalty for those who wage war against Allah and his messenger is killing or crucifixion and so on, and you see the Islamic State crucifying people for precisely that reason.
All right, we have just a few minutes left. Sometimes I feel so helpless when I see what's going on, especially to the Christians, you know, who are in the way of Islamic State, and then they're being killed, even their children being killed. What can we do about this?
Well, in the first place, we've got to do what we're doing right now. We've got to talk about it because most people are not aware of it. The mainstream media is not aware of all these things. They're not telling people these things. They're leaving Americans in a state of ignorance and complacency, and that is absolutely dangerous. The first thing we have to do is show our fellow Americans that the situation is dire, that the magnitude of the threat is large, and that being the case, it is imperative that we elect leaders who will deal honestly and realistically with this threat and end the denial and willful ignorance that characterizes our response to this threat today.
Could the U.S. itself be attacked by ISIS or IS, Islamic State?
I have no doubt about that. No doubt whatsoever, Jerry. I mean,
that it could be.
Seen, they love taunting the U.S. They've shown their signs in Ferguson, Missouri, Chicago, Washington, New York recently. And so I think it's only a matter of time.
Okay, elaborate on this.
Well, you know that they have shown the sign in Ferguson, Missouri, primarily the big ISIS is here banner. And I think it's noteworthy that the guy was walking along behind Jake Tapper of CNN while Jake was reporting about the riots. And the cameraman and nobody else who was watching the feed said, hey, turn around, talk to that fellow with the banner. And then he slipped away. And it's just an indication of how even the mainstream media, when they're confronted with this right in their face, they don't deal with it adequately. And in any case, the fact that ISIS or the Islamic State has sympathizers here or supporters here or even members here who are showing these signs, holding these banners, shows that they have the capacity to strike here. Because it doesn't take much. All you need is a few people, as the Tsarnaev brothers showed us in Boston.
Yeah.
A couple of people who assemble the parts for the bombs, and there you have it.
Wow. Didn't President Obama say recently that these people, talking about, again, Islamic State members, that they're not Muslims? In other words, no Muslims kill people or something like that, innocent people?
Yeah, they have nothing to do with Islam. And this is very common nowadays. Muslim groups, it has to be said, have been saying this. And Barack Obama said it. The Roman Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, Australia, said that what they have to do has nothing to do with Islam and so on.
Why
and
would they
the
say
thing
that?
Is that? Well, I think the non-Muslim leaders say it because it's just too terrible to contemplate the alternative and because they want to appear to be politically correct and not hateful and bigoted and so on. And they've fallen for the line from the Hamas-linked Council on American Islamic Relations and others that it's hateful and bigoted to speak realistically about the nature and magnitude of this threat. And the problem with the condemnations by the Muslims is that they're completely nonspecific. They don't ever explain exactly how the Islamic State is misusing or misrepresenting or misunderstanding the Quran and Islam. It's just vague and pro forma condemnation. And we don't see any program in the United States to teach Muslims why the understanding of Islam represented by the Islamic State is wrong, and that's very telling.
We have less than 45 seconds to go. How about a tie-in to your book, Arab Winter? Again, jihadwatch.org for more information. Robert Spencer is the author of Arab Winter. Go ahead.
Yeah, Arab Winter Comes to America is the name of the book, and Arab Winter Comes to America is about exactly this denial and willful ignorance that blankets the government and media response to the jihad threat and how it endangers us all. And so it's an attempt to try to enlighten Americans as to what's really going on, and it's available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and any self-respecting bookstore. Arab Winter Comes to America.
And also jihadwatch.org for more information. Robert, always a pleasure. Thank you for your important work.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
And I hate to keep saying it, but watch your back. Because I remember one of your endorsements even said something like that. It wasn't an endorsement, but one of those Muslim leaders was essentially announcing a curse on you. But what you do is so important. I appreciate your research and telling the truth about this stuff.
Much appreciate your willingness to take a stand, Jerry.
Okay. God bless. Bye-bye.